This is Malcolm Duck, and you're listening to Radio Golf Show.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, my name is Frank Forster, and this is Radio Golf Show. Tonight on the program, we have Dr. Rick Sessinghaus, the director of Flowcode Golf Academy and one of the most sought-after and respected mental coaches in all of golf. Rick is also a Golf Show All-Star, and his first appearance on this program ranks second, and a very close second, in the among all English language shows that we did. He's nipping at Ben Crenshaw's heels. But you got you know.
Okay, we got to do it today. Then.
So I think tonight it's going to put you over the top. But Ben was pretty good. We're thrilled he's back, and we got a lot to talk about. So let's get to it, Rick. Welcome back. How are you?
Thank you so much,
sir.
Doing great, Frank. Thanks for having me on. I enjoyed our last conversation, and I know we'll get into some cool stuff today.
I know we will. Why don't we start very quickly, if you don't mind? You know, you are, of course, the director of Flowcode Academy, and you were an established player as well. And you're not just a mental coach; you're also a swing coach, and you're involved with UCLA and all kinds of stuff. And people always say, "Oh, yeah, the mental coach of Colin Morikawa." and first of all, you're not only his mental coach; you're also his swing coach, correct?
That is correct. I've been his swing and mental coach since he's 8 years old. So it's been quite a journey.
And we just had the U.S. Open, which we watched here in Germany with great interest, because for me personally, I thought it was on a wonderful course, you know, a thinking man's course. Some people were complaining about that. The atmosphere wasn't really there. Colin did well. I think he finished
14th
top 15. Yeah, top 15. You know, I mean, his record, and I can't believe he's only 26, is he?
Right, correct.
You know, it's incredible. He's played in, I believe, 15 majors. He's made 13 cuts. He's got 7 top 10s. He's got 5 top 5s and 2 wins. I mean, that and his run when he had those 4 top 10 in a row in majors, that could be described as flow over time, couldn't it?
There you go. Yeah, no, solid player, and the majors, I think, to bring the best out of him, and he really enjoys the challenges for sure.
Yeah, and it seems like the U.S. Open is, I believe he finished, did he finish second there once or fourth? No, he finished fourth at Torrey Pines, right?
Finished fourth at Torrey Pines. He made a run on the Sunday, just didn't quite catch John Rahm that day.
So, I mean, at 26, you know, he's already got a U.S. Open and a Masters on a PGA and an Open under his belt.
Correct.
Is the career Grand Slam a long-term goal?
Of course. I mean, every week his goal is to win. So if the major happens to be that week, of course it is. But it's hard to get ahead of yourself too much, right? I mean, you want to be able to be prepared for this week, but hey, you got to get excited sometimes too, right?
Absolutely. I mean, were you pleased with his performance?
I think overall we're seeing some great trends. 2 weeks ago, and again, I'm dating myself here. We're June 26th of 2023 here, but 2 weeks prior, he played at the Memorial Tournament, Jack Nicklaus's tournament, and was playing very, very well. Unfortunately, on the Sunday, had to withdraw due to some back spasms, and the day before, he had made 8 birdies. He was 2 shots back of the lead. He was going in the right direction, right? And then have a week off, rehab, get his back ready. He's 100% on that, so he's fine. Go to the U.S. Open. And you know it's going to be a demanding golf course. And he didn't come out of the gates as fast as he would like, but came back with 369s in a row, had a lot of good positives going on and made a run on Sunday a little bit.
He was 4 under to 10, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So there's some good stuff with that. And so we're excited about how the rest of the season is coming about. But it was a positive result.
Yeah. Well, you guys got your 3 big ones out of the way with the Masters, of course, and with the U.S. Open. And now it's our turn with the Open and the Ryder Cup. So
awesome.
We're looking to seeing you over here. I'm sure you're excited about that. Now, the way I would like to structure today a little bit, if all right with you, Rick, is we want to talk specifically about the mental game. And I want to outline it in three categories. Let's talk maybe a little about motivation and assessing needs of your player. And maybe we can talk about it also, obviously, from your point as a coach. Talk a little bit about goal setting. You know, I just asked you if the career Grand Slam was a goal. And maybe we'll start there. And let's ask the big questions. Why set goals?
Yeah, no, goals provide focus. They provide, if done correctly, let's put it that way, creates a plan, our framework of practice. But basically, goal setting is a focus trigger. Our ability to pay attention to the present moment on what matters most can come from having proper goals, right? If I know where I'm going, what direction I'm going, it's much easier to focus. And, you know, goal setting, I think, people go, you're not supposed to think about outcomes. It's like, why not? Why not be have a goal of maybe being a scratch golfer or breaking 80 for the first time? So goals can provide one focus, but they can also provide motivation, right? Mm-hmm. They get us excited. They get us to move forward on things, right? Basic motivation is, what is your motive to take action?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you want to take action? Well, if I have goals that are aligned with what I want, they get me excited, I have a game plan, then we have goals and motivation working together, which is quite important. So goal setting, if done properly, create a plan, a pathway, but it comes down to I'm focused and it provides motivation moving forward.
Right. And that leads to my next point perfectly. How does one best set effective goals? Is it broken down into long-term, intermediate, and short-term, like a startup, like a business does it?
It certainly can. I look at it then. So we have time frames. So for all you golfers out there, you can certainly have time frames of maybe something way out in the distance, 5, 10 years, maybe 1 year from now, 6 months, 3 months, 1 month, 1 week, 1 day, this shot, right? We can have a goal on this shot, right? What's my target? Could be a goal. So we can have time frames. The other part of that built in is, I look at it as three different parts. Is one is an outcome. That's something we can definitely measure. Maybe you are a 13 index whose goal has always been to be a single digit. I want to be a 9 index, right? So that would be a measurable goal. That's an outcome goal. Mm-hmm. And that's important to get things started. But then I would follow up with that and say, well, what performance metrics are going to help us understand how we're going to move from a 13 index to a 9? That's 4 shots. Mm-hmm. So all the listeners out there, in this example, where would I get 4 shots from? Some of you, it might be your putting, it might be ball striking, it might be up and down percentage. And now with all the data we have with strokes gain data, all these different things, we can probably figure out where you're going to get those 4 shots from. And it could be simple things like you have 2-3 putts per round. And if I just eliminated one of those 3 putts, that's 1 shot right there. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's not saying things to do perfectly. It's like, what are the performance metrics? Basic ones, of course, are going to be fairways hit and greens regulation. But we tend to go a little deeper, especially with competitive golfers, is getting more data of what are the areas that they can improve, even if it's like 0.2 strokes and 0.1 strokes and up and down with wedges and how close do I get my iron shots, right? There's a lot of questions we can ask on performance that will lead to the improved outcome. Okay. Right. So I want to get to a 9 index. Well, what can I do there? Now, that can then help frame your process goals a little bit more. So let's use the putting example. I have 33 putts per round. I have 2-3 putts per round. And I can see that if I improve that and get the 33 putts down to 31 putts, one less 3 putt, right? Now we can start thinking, oh, okay, that would get me closer to my end goal. So my question though, for all the listeners would be, let's say it's putting. What specifically in putting do you need to work on, right? So is it getting the ball started on a line? Is it speed control? Is it green reading? Is it mindset, right? Now we're starting to get more and more specific in a goal that is my controllable. What can I do this week to improve my putting performance? And it could be doing putting with a mirror and checking your alignments. Could be. It could be I need to do more speed work. So that's where we get back into process goals, is what am I going to do today that's going to make me a better player? And I don't want to just say hit putts, because I think that's too vague. It could be, to improve my putting, I need to improve my speed control for 30 to 40 to 50 foot putts. I'm going to now practice this. I'm going to work on my tempo. I'm going to see, now we have something to work with, and you can then apply that into your practice on a weekend week and every week as you move forward, and you can then track it. Or am I actually getting better at that?
Right. So we're setting specific targets which are measurable. I think that's absolutely important, and which I guess at the same time should not be easily influenced by others. Rephrase maybe the three types of goals that you mentioned, the outcome, yes, performance, and process. I think from those three goals, the outcome goals, which are like finishing the top five, getting into the second round of the match play at the club championship, shooting a number, right?
Correct.
I think and those kind of goals, the outcome goals, are the ones where a player only has partial control, because a lot of other influences happen. Then we have the performance goals, which are much more flexible, obviously, and they can also easily be changed to satisfy the immediate need of a player. Right. I mean, that's like, I'm hitting, like you said, you know, I'm hitting nine greens on average, and I want to hit 10 or 11. That would be a performance goal.
Correct.
Yes. Okay.
Correct. We could still measure it.
Right.
Okay. And it's leading us closer to the end outcome goal. So I ask people, you know, what would a 9 index player be like? Right. They would be a little better at putting, a little better at full swing, a little right now. How do you quantify that is a little tricky, but I think with the data-driven applications we now have on and strokes gained, we're much easier now to be able to be realistic about where our game is. I want to backtrack real quick on goals. So flow, which is a state of peak performance, optimal experience, their research into goal setting is, can we push you daily 1 to 4% outside your current state or your current skill set, right? Mm-hmm. So if I am going to chip a ball near the green and currently my average is 6.5 feet, right? Well, tomorrow I could have a goal that I want to chip the ball to 6 feet 2 inches instead of 6 feet 6 inches, right? And now I'm having incremental goals that are moving me forward, but they're very realistic. 1 to 4% outside your current skill set is going to push you, but it's not going to make you anxious. If I said, okay, you hit the ball 250 yards tomorrow, I want you to hit 300 yards. You're going to like, that's a nice goal, but it's not going to happen.
Exactly.
Right. So if we can go back to setting goals that are, you know, week to week, that are a little more incremental,
right,
then it's pushing us. It's going to help us focus, but we don't feel anxious because, oh, there's no way I can do it. You already have, you know, wasted your time. So we want to make sure that the goals are incremental. 1 to 4% outside your current skill set is kind of the research that shows. And then back to when we talk about the processes is, what can I do today to become a better player? And that could be mental game stuff, which we'll get into also. It could be doing meditation and mindfulness and visualization and those things that have nothing to do with your swing grip or anything like that, but understanding the puzzle piece of shooting lower scores, there's a lot of puzzle pieces.
Right.
Let's make sure we're working on the right puzzle pieces.
Exactly. And the process goals are the ones that you just mentioned. They talk about the mental state, they talked about the technique, they talk about physical actions, they talk about going to the gym, that kind of stuff, correct?
Exactly. If I want to hit the ball further, one of the goals might be to improve clubhead speed, which means I need to maybe work on my technique, but I may need to get stronger in the gym, and I need maybe need to do explosive exercises. Now we're getting very, very specific of what we're doing and why, and then that leads to another goal down the road.
Yeah, I'm not going to the gym. There's no chance of that happening. How difficult, and you talked about it a little bit, about goals being realistic. How difficult should goals be?
Yeah, just outside of your current state. Tomorrow, just outside the current state. Okay. So if I go back to the gym, because you're always in the gym, right?
That's right.
and you bench press, here in the States, if you bench press 100 pounds, and then that's the max I can do with one rep.
Is that good?
Well, it's not.
I don't know. I mean, never bench press anything.
Oh, come on. Okay. Have you ever done a push-up?
Yeah, two or three.
Okay. Two or three. So let's say you've done two. Uh-huh. Tomorrow, maybe the goal's three.
Right.
The goal's three, right? It's incrementally. It's not trying to our ego and say, yes, tomorrow I'm going to put on twice as much poundage on the bench press. So same thing with golf, is that it's the incremental consistency of working towards the goal that is going to lead to long-term development, not just short-term fixes. But we want to make the goal challenging enough to get your attention. A lot of golfers practice, they're passionate, but they're wasting the time in practice because it's either boring or they're not working on the right things. And then they're really not improving their skills because their process goals have not been clearly defined. They're not challenging enough to keep their attention. And there's not, the last part of it is a feedback loop. At the end of that practice session, did you actually get better or not?
Mm-hmm.
It's great to put all this time in, but are you learning from it? Yeah. Did you get better? And I don't think a lot of golfers do that. I used to journalize all my practice sessions. I have a lot of my clients, they have to send me an email at the end of the week. This is what I did. That's right. Like, how many balls did I hit? But what did I actually accomplish? I worked on speed control with putting. I have a much better feel. My grip pressure now is less. Now we have a true cause and effect. Mm-hmm. That is the feedback loop that happens at the end of it.
So you make the player evaluate the goals.
Not only evaluate the goals, but now evaluate once they did the process goals. I worked on my putting today for 30 minutes and I did these drills. After they did it, do they feel like they got better or not?
Mm-hmm.
I have plenty of players who practice a lot, but they don't get better.
Right.
So to me, they're not assessing, is the practice getting them closer?
Okay.
And so, yes, there's a feedback loop after every practice session.
Right. And if you don't mind, if I could ask you another question about Colin, how do you guys go about planning a set of goals for one of the best players in the world?
Well, I think we're fortunate and spoiled a little bit that every shot that he hits on the PGA Tour is measured by a laser, and we know it down to the literally down to the foot or down to the meter where it went.
Okay.
So we know his patterns week to week very easily. There's no guesswork that's happening. So we will, and we're not big stat people, so I don't want to get lost that, oh, we're looking at all. But you look at trends, and whether it's putting or approach game with his irons, or whether it's up and down percentage out of a bunker, whatever it may be, we have that data every day. It's updated on the PGA Tour website.
Yeah.
And you now can see what's happening. So there's no opinion like, oh, this is good, this is bad. We know factually what's happening. So that's where the best players in the world, they're lucky that they have the data, and we will look at it, certainly. And I get his caddy's feedback, what he's seeing, what he's experiencing. And then there's just this, I trust Colin's feedback too. Hey, how did it go out there? The US Open. He didn't adapt to the speed of the green the first day. Thought they were going to be a little slower. They were faster. So that's not a stroke issue. That was something to do with his routine and adaptability.
Mm-hmm.
So if we ask the better questions, I think we get down to the root cause of performance.
Right. And let's maybe finish up this topic of goal setting. The three types of goals, the outcome, the performance, and the process. Is it then what defines a outstanding coach to find the balance between these three types of goals for every player?
Yeah, I think you're going to find that Most golfers are on the extremes. I have a lot of golfers that they love to tell me their outcome goals because it motivates them. Yes, next year I'm going to break 80, and they're excited about outcome goals, and that's fine, but they have zero plan of how to achieve it. And then I have other people, which are what I'll call the fixers, the band-aids. It's like, what tomorrow do I need to do? I need to try this. And there's no plan, but they're very clear on what they're going to do in the practice for tomorrow, but it's not really leading them to a long-term goal. Those are the extremes. So I am checking in with people. It's like, when somebody works with me, they have to fill out a mental assessment. And the first section is goals. Mm-hmm. What do you want to achieve outcome-wise? What are the things that are gaps right now that you're not getting to that? Do you have a plan, right? Pretty basic questions, but most people are like, oh, I haven't thought about it that way.
Exactly.
They just, their goal is, I just want to get better. And I go, what does that mean? I don't know what better means. So I help with some clarity, help them write it down. We then ask different questions. And then it's, and again, the golfers that are listening to this, I'm assuming you don't have the luxury of being at PGA Tour courses all the time with the best practice facilities and as much time as you want. So you have to prioritize your time and the resources you have. You may not have a great practice chipping area to work on short game. You have to prioritize differently, right? So please, I don't want to come across like, yes, everybody has 50 hours to work on their golf game per week. That's not happening. How do you prioritize things you can do at home, in the gym, mm-hmm. when you go to the range, making the most of that time, I think is crucial.
Right. And I think, you know, most of us know that the better you get, that you know, to go down that extra half shot or a shot on your handicap gets harder and harder.
Yes.
You know, we all know about plateaus, but fascinating stuff about goal setting that is not really talked about enough, I think. Let's move on to some of the mental skills for golf, and maybe we'll start with peak performance. You know, golfers everywhere, whenever you see an interview of people who play well, or even amateurs just play on the weekend, they cite mental factors as critical components of their experience of a peak performance. I read some, I think peak performance as a mathematical formula. Peak performance is potential minus interference. I don't know who said that, but
yeah, it's been around in sports psychology for a long
forever,
time.
Right. Correct. Yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense, right?
Yes.
Which mental factors, and I guess when we talk about mental factors, we talk about feelings as well, right? Which mental factors are most commonly associated with peak performance?
Sure.
Fear,
yeah,
I believe, right?
Yeah, fear would be the opposite of peak performance, right?
Well, yeah, it's the opposite. I mean,
so with flow, we look at fear is anxiety. It's in the future. It's worry. What's going to go wrong? Flow state is in the present moment. We have some level of control over the environment. We believe we have the skills to match the challenge, right? So if we just compare and contrast those, is a mindset mental game of distraction. I'm distracted. I have doubt. I have fear. I have tension. I'm in a stress response. Okay, that's what we don't want, obviously. And what do we want? What are the mental game skills we want? We want to be fully focused in the present moment on what is relevant on the shot. We want to be confident that we have the skills to match the challenge in front of us. I believe I can hit the shot, right? Then you mentioned feelings. Now, confidence is a feeling. I think it's also a skill, but feelings, like, do you play your best? Mine is engaged. When I feel like I'm engaged in the shot, I play my best. If you're creative, maybe you play best golf creative or relaxed or peaceful or excited or so on and so forth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is those the focus, confidence, and emotions are the big three. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about we have potential, which is sometimes hard to define, by the way, mm-hmm. but let's use that as the example. Minus interference. So interference could be a distraction. It could mm-hmm. be a doubt. It could be a fear.
Yeah.
And then that takes away from our skill set, and then we get the end result, which is the performance, yeah. right? So when we look at these three things, is it the listener out there, are you focusing on what's relevant in that shot? And I know we covered this a little last time, but pre-shot routine is, there's a mental component of this. It's not about not thinking. In fact, It's about thinking about this particular shot and what the lie is doing, what the wind is doing, how firm is this green, and where's the hole location? Was that we get to problem solve. To me, that's a cool part of golf.
Right.
Okay. So focus is paying attention to all those relevant information so we can make a decision that aligns with our skills. 30 years ago, when I was playing professional golf, I hit the ball a lot longer than I do now. I had a lot of different skill sets than I do now. Yet we have to understand what is our skill, right? Be realistic with your skill, not your ego. Okay. And then confidence in flow is when we truly believe we have the skills to match the challenge that's in front of us, right? And when we do that, great. If it's too big of a challenge, we're going to be in an anxious state. And here's the thing people need to understand. Peak performance is not about hoping things get easier, by the way. Easy, something easy creates boredom. It doesn't get us engaged. Ah, this is an easy shot. And then we make a mistake. Yeah. So we want to challenge ourselves on a shot-by-shot basis. So peak performance is being engaged and focused and confident, but taking on challenge, pushing ourselves, and of course, embracing pressure, embracing that this matters instead of interference, like, oh no, this matters. I don't want to mess up. I don't want to embarrass myself. So there's a lot of potential interferences out there.
Yeah. Maybe we can jump on what you just said about this not thinking, and one of the myths of the mental game that you talk about in one of the past episodes in your podcast, which is coming back. You just told me, which I'm looking forward to. When people say, "Oh, you should not be thinking at all," I talked to a European tour player just last week about it. And I asked him about that, and his answer was, you can't be numb to it all, but you got to be numb to some degree. That's the way he defined it, and I found that very very interesting. But let's talk about the peak. I find this absolutely fascinating, and we had exchanged thoughts briefly about Rupert Sheldrake, who was on a couple of weeks ago, and we're talking about. Where are the functions for the peak performance located? In the right hemisphere of the brain or the left hemisphere of the brain? I happen to think it's the right. I don't know what Rupert thinks, but he thinks it's probably somewhere even outside the brain. The left hemisphere of the brain is where we process the information, correct? I mean, it's the analytical thinking, verbal, and things like this. But peak performance is probably rooted on the right side, where we have perception of visual and spatial relationships, images, nonverbal communication, that kind of thing. Would you agree with that?
I would. It's hard for me to just put it into one or the other. I think we got stuck, let's say 10 or 15 years ago in sports psychology of saying something was an analytical left side versus right side creative. And I think we tried to separate them way too much. I mean, being at the US Open, a couple of weeks ago, you saw these players in practice rounds thinking a lot and processing an environment. And on the sixth hole, which was a reachable par four, drivable, you had to make a decision. You had to now be aware. So there was a lot of analytical thinking happening. Once a decision's being made, you're giving it up to your subconscious, like, okay, go do it. I'm giving you a direction. And then there's certainly less thinking at that point, right? We're being a reactionary athlete, hopefully. But it's hard for me to say one is more important than the other. In the moment of performing, you're exactly right. We don't want to be thinking of the performance. But golf is an interesting sport where it's non-reactionary. You could have the beautiful golf swing, not think, but make the wrong decision, and you hit it over the green, you're going to make double bogey or whatever.
Yeah.
So I like to look at golf is a little different than other sports, where other sports is very reactionary, where we're having to perceive things quite quickly, trusting our subconscious a little bit more. I think golf, because the ball doesn't move and the target doesn't move, I think that's what I love about it. I think it's a mix, honestly.
Right. But that shift from left brain to right brain, is that where, and you've talked about triggers and anchors, is that
correct?
Helps you with that switch?
Yeah, I think 10 years ago or so, if you asked me, I would purely think it was just a visualization thing of creativity. So posing the question, what does a good shot look like here, is a way of taking a problem solving, turning it into a visualization. Visualization is more creative. I don't disagree with that, other than I would add more to that. So studying flow, we know there's different triggers. That happens to be a visual trigger. But if I ask somebody, what does a good shot feel like here? Now we have what we call a deep embodiment trigger. I'm feeling a golf shot. That's pretty nice. And then I have some people who are very auditory trigger wise. Tempo is important. Oh gosh, if I just smooth, or if I pretend I'm Freddie Couples with his swing, that could become a trigger too. That
I've used
takes
that.
us,
I love him. I
you
love Freddie.
betcha,
I
you
love Freddie.
betcha, right? Is we take all this, what we'll call as a complicated motion, because golf swing has a lot of moving parts, but how do you simplify, trust, and let it go? There are many, many, many ways, I think, to go from thinking to doing.
Okay. You mentioned before the routine, the pre-shot routine, and I found this great quote. It's from Davis Love Jr. A routine is not a routine if you have to think about it. How about them apples?
That, okay, that's an interesting, okay. I think where I've heard that I had a player who was OCD, so he thought through everything of his routine, down to how many breaths he did, how many practices, and that became a distraction in and of itself, because now you're trying to make a perfect routine. Certainly, me brushing my teeth in the morning, I'm not thinking about it. It is a routine. It's a habit. I get that. And yes, you do something over and over and again that you're not thinking about. I would agree to that with a point. I think I have some people's routines slightly changed depending on the shot. So hitting a flop shot is different than hitting a driver, and I think there might be a different routine involved. But you're right. We were trying to take out as much, like, thinking about the thinking as possible.
There you go. Is confidence the most desired skill for golf?
If you asked me that 10 years ago, I would have said yes. I think I've shifted a little bit, because flow state always starts with focus. So your ability to pay attention to the present moment is a superpower, and that has to happen. So then you can say confidence becomes second. If I'm distracted, if I am not paying attention to my environment, I'm not, it doesn't matter how confident I am, I'm probably picking the wrong club. I'm not. So my ability to stay in this 20 to 30 second bubble and pay attention to what's relevant is the number one skill. Now, I've taken the club out now. My belief in executing the golf shot, which is confidence, of course, now becomes the second piece of the puzzle. Okay. Confidence is interesting, because I think it back in the day, it was just easy. Oh, be positive. Be, and I don't think that's a great tool. I think confidence comes from many different factors. It can come from past results, it can come from practice, it can come from preparation. In the moment, self-talk is the number one thing that'll trigger. What am I saying to myself right before I'm hitting a shot? Pretty important. And visualizing a shot, if I can see success before it happens. But to take it a step further, I was talking to another performance psychologist about confidence, because there's things that we can debate on that. He says it's pretty simple. He says you're going to be confident when you do hard things over and over again. And I go, huh, that's interesting. So you think back, why are we confident? It's not that in this moment we're actually going to hit the shot. It's just we've put in the work. We can see that yesterday we wish we slept in, but we went to the range anyways. We did something hard, and now our identity is like, I like hard things. I have confidence that I can take on a challenge. That's a big picture of confidence, which I think is great. But in the moment, hitting this flop shot over the bunker to a tight pin, when the last one you've sculled over the green, now we have some potential interference and doubt, right? So that's where I think there's other things at the disposal of visualization, remembering past great shots, you know, hey, I've got this. Breathing can be a way to regulate a little bit of tension. So yeah, confidence is an interesting one because most people's confidence is just based on the result that they just had. If I hit a good shot, I feel good about myself. If I hit a poor shot, I don't feel so good.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, simple things, which are always the big questions. What are the sources of confidence? You know, you never really think about that, you know.
And, totally.
Yeah. So, but while we're at it, let's talk about some of those techniques you just mentioned and how you coach them. I mean, imagery and imagery, when you mention imagery, people just think about visualization, but it's all senses, isn't it? It's just totally. Just not just seeing, it's hearing, it's smelling, it's feeling, it's tasting, correct?
Exactly. And going back to the Fred Couples idea, when I wrote my first book, I talked about a section in there where when I was a 16-year-old kid, I pretended that I was swinging like Freddie Couples. And part of it was tempo. We appreciate his tempo. But for me, it was the relaxation. His shoulders were so relaxed and just like, and I became him. And so now, yes, there's the seeing a shot, but I'm now being him, and I'm kind of do a pre-shot routine like him, and I just kind of touch the sleeve of my shirt, and I just let things drop, and so we can get really creative, and so we can model somebody else, right? I can model their swing, I can model their personality, I can model their processes, which will make me feel different, right? And now in this day and age, maybe somebody wants to practice and be like Rory or something like that, fine. But it's not that I'm going to hit it like Freddie, but in that moment, I am focusing on something that would probably lead to a better shot, being relaxed and smooth and just like carefree. That's what Freddie meant to me. Mm-hmm. So we can encompass many different types of trigger, whether they're visual, whether they're kinesthetic, whether they're auditory, so that's where we get to experiment, which I think is fun.
Yeah. I mean, like an example would be for the auditory. I mean, when you read your putt and your line, and the last thing you do is you hear the sound of the ball dropping into the cup before you step up to the ball. I mean, that would be an example of it. A little personal. I promised my wife I'd not do any personal anecdote, but she's sleeping.
Uh-oh. Edit this out.
No. You know what? We've been heard in 54 countries, okay, around the world. And my wife and my mother-in-law and my sister-in-law and that whole family, they live in Belarus, okay? Now, I ask you this. How many times do you think we've been heard in Belarus? Zero.
Uh-oh.
I don't know why. They don't care. Anyways, I remember playing in a tournament, and I didn't pull a total Walter Hagen, but I got maybe 4 or 5 hours of sleep, and I had a couple of drinks the night before, and I wasn't feeling too well. And then I was playing okay, and then I at some point I got this very strange taste in my mouth, not like getting sick or something, but a taste I've never had before. And I hit the most amazing shot I've ever hit. I remember it. It was a Bethpage Black on the par five. I think it's a six hole from the fairway bunker, just with a six iron over the tree, you know, and into the fairway. Nothing spectacular, but it was probably the best shot I've ever hit. And ever since then, I'm trying to recreate this taste in my mouth when I do play without having to pull a Walter Hagen.
Right.
So, ladies and gentlemen, it's more than just visualization, this imagery. But is imagery the mental skill that elite golfers like Colin, like the guys that were out at LACC, use more than any other?
My short answer is yes, but I think what they're starting to learn is that visualization is not necessarily the best tool for every single player. I think they've been trained at an early age to use visualization and a pre-shot routine to see the shot. I do believe that. Mm-hmm. But some players who we call that a deep embodiment trigger, some people who are very feel players, the practice swing and feel, let's say I'm hitting a cut, a fade, and I do a practice swing where I hold the face off, that might be more beneficial for somebody than seeing the fade. Mm-hmm. Okay. So now I'm feeling a shot before I play it, or some is more beneficial than seeing the shot. So I would say that all players are seeing a shot on the PGA Tour. How clear the picture is, that's a whole other conversation. Mm-hmm. But they have an intention, right? There's a target. I'm going to hit it here. It's going to go there. But I think other people, it's feel-based also. And then even auditory-based is smoothness and tempo. And that becomes a trigger for them also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you mentioned self-talk. I mean, and I hear also, I mean, it's not only the things that we hear the players say, the external vocalization, but it's also the internal. And I guess that's where also some of the negative stuff happens. But is self-talk mostly used to control emotions? And does it have an obviously it has an effect on confidence. And it you know it, Bernard Langer once said a wrong decision is less disastrous than indecision or something like that.
It's better to It's better to be you know, if you're wrong, okay, but you were committed to the decision, then indecisive and you went with it anyways, right? Right. I mean, then you but I self-talk is interesting because if we look at self-talk as thoughts, right? Thoughts pop in and out of our head consistently. Some of the research says we have tens of thousands of thoughts per day. Most of those thoughts are the same we had yesterday. And most of them are critical, judgmental, and negative. Whew, that's a lot going on there, right?
It's a lot.
So what happens is those thoughts start to frame our belief systems, right? They become our beliefs. What we run over and over again becomes a belief. So I would ask people, what are the thoughts you're having? Now, before a shot, if I'm having, oh, I don't like downhill left to right putts, that's probably not putting us in a great state to want to hit this downhill left to right putt, right? Mm-hmm. So I use self-talk and I flip it a little bit. I use questions that is self-talk to help guide where my focus on. So if my thought is, oh, I don't like left to right putts, I might ask, have I ever made a left to right foot putt? And of course the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. I made thousands of them. So now I've shifted my focus by asking a better question. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, oh, when I have made those, how did those feel? Well, they felt smooth and I could see the shot coming in here and it's going to enter at 5 o'clock, right? Or whatever it may be. So that's where we can now harness questions differently. It's not just rah, rah, yes, believe in myself, say I'm the greatest putter of all time. I'm not into that kind of self-talk, but I am definitely into being able to shift and ask better questions to redirect our belief systems.
Mm-hmm. That's just so much stuff, and our hour is almost up. I mean, you know, we can talk for hours about confidence, about relaxation techniques, and things like this. Before we tell the folks a little bit about the Flowcode Academy and what they can do to tap into that, Claude Harmon, 48 Masters champion, said once, "The club and the ball don't know your name." which is what I was reminded of when Wyndham Clark won the Open.
Yes,
not really as a no name, but it was a bit of surprise. That reminded me of a story that after Jeff Sluman, and maybe you know the story, won the 88 PGA Championship. And he entered the next tournament. He got so much attention from the media and the spectators who all wanted to watch him play. And in the next tournament, he stood on the first tee with a large crowd there who were waiting to see this new champion. And he only was thinking about one thing, which was not to blow it. And that thought, you know, is associated with nothing but negative emotions and feelings. And, you know, embarrassment and everything. And it caused so much tension and fear in him that his opening tee shot in the next tournament flew a total of 30 yards. I don't know if you know that story. How does a guy like Wyndham Clark, and maybe you experienced it with Colin when he won his first, the first PGA championship sure. he entered and the first Open he entered. How does a guy deal with this mentally now moving forward? I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, I think that there's two there's two unhealthy ways, which I'll talk about first. The Jeff Sluman way of, oh, I don't want to embarrass myself. People think I'm going to do this. And they're in a fear mindset of don't screw this up. I think with other top players, sometimes the expectation gets so high that they feel like they have to do it again and again to prove themselves. I think Colin was pretty good in the middle where he got prepared. He wins a tournament, goes, great. Yeah, I'm prepared to win that. I believe I'm a player who can win majors. Great. You go to the next event, he's, you know, and he wins, you know, the next year at the Open Championship. He's like, there's a belief identity that I'm the type of person that can do that is different. Like, oh, maybe I got lucky. Maybe people are going to see, you know, I'm an imposter syndrome type of thing. Right. And the fear of that. And then I think other people try to be perfect because their expectation level has gotten so high. So it's tricky. You would think good results is going to help us with more good results, but sometimes people have a difficult time dealing with it. Is that really, am I good? That good a player? Maybe I got lucky. And right. they start to sabotage
negative flow
on that too.
Negative.
Totally.
Flow. One quick question before you tell, if you have a few minutes to tell us
yes.
about Flow Code, and I saw on your website, and I follow your website, and I follow your podcast, and all that stuff. You talk about, you know, teaching flow to juniors. That I find fascinating. I mean, you think, oh, yes. Sports psychology. You know, what do the kids have to? You know, they have no fear. They don't need to know about flow, right?
Well, yeah, and I think if you look into some of the flow research, some of the stuff that I've read is like for all of us. Whether you play golf or not, that's irrelevant. But from the ages of 0 to 8, when we are children, we are in much more likely to be in a flow state than any other time in our life. Okay. Mm-hmm. When we're in that 0 to 8, we're very playful. We're obviously childlike. We get to be use our imagination a lot. We're playing with dolls and toys and cars and creating things with and then unfortunately something happens when we get a little older, even our 11, 12, 13, there's a more of a critical voice that pops in. Oh, my mom, my dad told me that doesn't look like a race car anymore when I draw it. Uh-oh. Then I don't want to let them down. And then they go to school and everything's talked about, well, you missed this on the, so we get more and more critical and we get further away from being in that focused, playful state, creative state. So in golf, unfortunately, what we're seeing here, I'm in California here in the States, and the golfers are playing competitive golf at earlier and earlier ages. And unfortunately in an unhealthy environment where they're only given attention if they win a medal instead of, hey, did you have fun out there? What was a cool shot you hit? Right?
Right.
And so we're finding that even though a younger player, like you said, shouldn't have any fear, we're seeing it creep in at an earlier age. Mm. And we know that we can, part of it, educate the parents, but help these younger players get back to that creative imagination, playful attitude, which is part of what flow is, then it's going to help them in the future.
Exactly. Exactly. Fascinating stuff. Please tell us about Flow Code. The website is theflowcode.com.
We have that one that has all of our offerings. If for golf, it's flowcode.golf, flowcode.golf. That's our golf site. The other one has our corporate, all kinds of, we're doing all kinds of stuff in that.
Flow works everywhere. You know, it works with your friends. You're in the flow with your friends. When you have a good night with your friends, you're in the flow.
You bet it does. So we have a lot of like free master classes on there, videos, the podcast. We have 2 seasons of Flow Golf, which is going to be rebranded coming up here in a couple months with Flow Code, and just sharing that information and love to help golfers not only play better golf, but as you know, enjoy the game more.
Absolutely. Rick Fair is on the team, correct?
Yes, Rick is fantastic. We've got to know him the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And here's a player who's won on the PGA Tour at the highest level. Now he's a coach.
Exactly.
And being able to look at it, his perspective, it has taught me a lot too. And he understands the principles of how they can help people play better golf.
He always seemed like one of the good guys.
Totally.
And do you also educate and certify Flow Code coaches? Is it also, it's not
yes.
just for players.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. We've been fortunate. We've certified as of today, 115 coaches worldwide. We have associations with PGA of Norway and South Africa and Australia, and obviously here in the States. And that's a big part, is that to mentor these coaches to help their students perform better with these flow principles is something that means a lot to me as a coach.
Great. Good stuff. Good stuff. Wish you nothing but the best. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
And thank you, Frank.
And sometimes it is better the second time than it was the first. Look, I wish you and Colin the best of things the rest of the year. We look forward to seeing you over here in Europe at the Open and at the Ryder Cup. I'm sure that'll be interesting.
Yes.
Take good care of yourself. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, that was the show with Dr. Rick Sessinghaus. Thank you for joining To the Linkland.